It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper with a question. Could a single idea turn you into an exceptional cook? Well, that's the question we address today with an indisputably excellent cook, Mario Batali.
Having lived in California, where simplicity seemed to be what cooking was all about, it was really not as simple as it really is in Italy. So when you make a dish of pappardelle and peas in Italy, it really only has pappardelle and peas. And to understand that is a giant step, especially for your ego, to get over the fact that you have to realize that the shopping is probably 80%. Getting the right pea is so much more important than the technical ability of the chef.
Today we go straight to the source of those great ingredients, the farmer, with Mario Batali and his book, America, Farm to Table. That's this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. On the prowl for the very best in your farmer's market, pace the place with a chef. Few people are as diligent in their search for the pristine and the delicious, the creamiest of potatoes, the brightest Swiss chard, the earthiest rutabaga. Chefs understand that farmers are the key. They're the real rock stars of the culinary world. Well, our own favorite rock star, Chef Mario Batali, has taken that idea and run with it with his new book, America, Farm to Table. Mario, great to have you back.
Always a delight to be basking in your golden aura.
I love that line. We have to patent that or something.
You can have it. I love it.
All right. But, you know, set up the book for us.
Okay. Well, all of my books up until now have been about Italian cooking, whether restaurant or holiday or specific regional. And it occurred to me that what I really cook at home, although a lot of times influenced by Italian culture, is often just kind of American food that's tasty. And then it occurred to me that when I talk to all the people that love the shows or the restaurants or anything that I do, they're always trying to figure out how to make their food more delicious at their house. And often the first step is, yes, I'll start buying recipes. The second step is, yes, I'll be careful and watch and try to be really attentive. The third step is to buy equipment, like they want to buy the saute pan or the braising pan or the kind of knife. And it occurred to me that very rarely, outside of a white truffle or a specific kind of Parmigiano Reggiano, they rarely ask me where, like, I get my lettuce. And it occurred to me that the most delicious things that we make are often stuff that's grown in and around our world. And it's not necessarily fancy or hard to get. It's just a question of sourcing it. So with the idea of helping people make more delicious food at the home,
right,
I realized that I should introduce them to the farmers that are the most influential to me and my pals. So this shows you 14 farms, 14 chefs, and the idea of supporting a local farmer and getting the most tasty local specific ingredients in their season, which is very almost intuitive to all of us, is where this book wants you to go.
And that makes sense because when it's in season, A, it's usually cheaper, and B, it tastes better.
Well, right. I mean, you know, you get a strawberry on Christmas Eve, but is it good? Well, it's not bad. Inherently, food is good. But if you want the peak seasonal explosion that a strawberry is, you should eat strawberries when they're in season around where you are. And, you know, whatever happens to be your favorite thing, when you get it from where you are, there's the flavor, the kind of pride that when you're tasting a porcino in Emilia Romagna, high in the hills between Florence and Bologna, it tastes different there than it does 200 miles away. And the Italians appreciate that, and the Americans are learning to appreciate that geospecificity that can be something so unique and something that can bring you to such pride that it's remarkable.
Give me an example of a farmer that you talked to.
Well, we have our summer house in northern Michigan, and there is a farmer in the fourth generation called Bardenhagen Farms, and they grow cherries and apples. And when you taste a cherry right up the tree in Michigan during cherry season, keep in mind, I was born and raised in Washington State, so we had eastern Washington, the Wenatchee Yakima Valley cherries, were the same thing. There was a crunch. There was a tanginess. There was a brightness to it that is something that it doesn't make all the rest of the cherries look bad. It just makes this cherry look better. And if you can find that, and then also find someone whose story that you love, the Bardenhagen fourth generation farmer, and to taste their specific varietals that their family has kind of treasured and held close to their heart, it's tasting the soul of American geology. It's tasting the dirt itself. And when the dirt can express itself in a way like that through the farmer who has managed and curated that, it becomes something so delicious and yet so just simple. I mean, it doesn't have to be so revered. It just has to be something that you recognize and accept. And in doing that, you're doing service to both the farmer and the dirt.
You know, I'm trying to remember, as I was reading the book, wasn't there one farmer who was obsessed with certain seeds? Who was that?
That's David Cleverdon. He's the owner of Kinnikinnick Farm in Caledonia, Illinois, which services Chicago, more or less. And he and Paul Kahan, who has all the great, my favorite restaurants in Chicago, a magnificent butcher shop. He's the Zen master that I aspire to be. And when he talked about this head of escarole or this particular kind of spigarello, which is a flowering kind of broccoli, he got into this farmer's head who decided he really wanted to find the seed, and he couldn't get it exactly right. And he grew it for a year, and he looked at it, and he didn't like it. And he grew it for another year, and he looked at it, and he didn't grow it. He even planted things outside of his growing region in Michigan to think that he could hide or sneak these seeds around without anybody seeing them. He desperately wanted to have a very unique and positive crop. And eventually he found some of the old seeds in the back of his barn, planted them, and now he has exactly what he was looking for. But, you know, in the same thing that a chef's quest for the perfect ravioli or the magnificent preparation of the first asparagus of the year, these farmers obsess about delivering that primary product that only with that could we ever make these great dishes.
All right, let's change gears here a little bit because I want to know what you're cooking with this stuff because you created the recipes.
Absolutely.
Around the ingredients these farmers were growing, right?
Right.
So give me some examples.
Well, the braising greens we just talked about, like that for me is something that when you take these kind of greens and cook them with just a little bit of sausage and you cook them until they're dust, in the Italian vernacular, they fall apart. And when you toss them with homemade orecchiette, you are suddenly as good as anywhere in Puglia eating something that speaks to you of the soil and the flavor of the place. When I talk to the oysters that Smokey brings me from Pemaquid, and they respond to me by giving me, like some of them are just raw, some of them we put on the barbecue with just a little kind of a glaze of butter oil and chopped up herbs, that oyster tells me something that is remarkable. When you taste the beets, you know, from Phoenix Farms in Texas, they're magnificent, but there are great beets all over the country. So you could make this borscht with any local beet, and you could make it with the supermarket beet, too. I don't want to diminish the potential excellence for each of the local people shopping in their Piggly Wiggly or wherever they happen to be shopping with, because you still get good products. But if you could celebrate a local farmer, you're going to find yourself in a little higher realm.
Mario, you inspire, my friend, and thank you.
My pleasure.
Mario Batali's book, co-written with journalist Jim Webster, is America, Farm to Table, Simple, Delicious Recipes Celebrating Local Farmers. Now, you can find Mario's recipe for an unusual and delicious dish, potato and salami cheesecake. Check it out, splendidtable.org. You know how you feel when your plane takes off for home and you realize that you've missed out on the best fried chicken joint in the South? Well, now Jane and Michael Stern can save you from that suffering. They scout all of the best sleeves-up mom-and-pop eats all over the United States for their site, roadfood.com, and for us. Hey, Jane, Michael, what's the latest? What have you discovered?
Well, and we've been traveling around Quebec trying to find an answer to the question, is there such a thing as good poutine?
Can you explain what poutine is?
Good idea, well, Jane. Great idea.
Few foods have so horrible a reputation as poutine. Basically, what it is French fries topped with cheese curds, topped with gravy, or topped with gravy and then cheese curds. And if the French fries are flabby and the gravy is from a can and the cheese curds aren't really curds at all but some kind of horrible shredded mozzarella from a bag, it can be one of the worst dishes on earth. On the other hand, there are many what they call casse-croûte, which is a snack bar in Quebec that use really good French fries. You know, they double fry them that Quebec way when they're really crisp on the outside and creamy inside. They make their own gravy and use fresh cheese curds. They're, you know, really squeaky. It's a magnificent dish when done right. In fact, if you travel in the up in the far northeast kingdom, like way up north in northernmost Maine around the international boundary, there are a lot of restaurants that serve what they call a mix, M-I-X, which is the local name for poutine. And what they do is use flavorless mozzarella instead of cheese curds, and it totally destroys the dish.
So where you're in Quebec, where do you go for the dynamite poutine?
Michael has to say these because you know my French and how atrocious it is. So Michael, say the names of the places.
Okay. Well, all right. First, let me start with a very unusual one in Montreal itself. Lynn, I'm sure you know Moishe's, the steakhouse.
Oh, yes, yes.
Well, they make a super deluxe poutine. It really doesn't count because instead of gravy, they have slices of filet mignon and like really good gravy.
Oh, brother.
I mean, it doesn't really count, but it's an awfully good dish. But for, you know, regular kind of snack bar poutine, there's a place called Chez Michelin just west of Quebec City that, you know, just the curds just like squeak if you look at them. And the gravy is kind of grainy and fresh. And the French fries are just those really good twice-cooked French fries. I mean, you really understand when you eat this dish at Chez Michelin how good it can be.
My mouth is watering. Where else?
Well, here's a really weird one that we were actually in Fort Kent, which is the northernmost tip of Route 1 at, you know, the northernmost part of Maine. And we were asking around, where can a person get really good poutine? Somebody sent us right over the border into Clare, you know, in New Brunswick, and a restaurant called Maple Leaf, which is actually, believe it or not, a Chinese restaurant.
Chinese-Canadian.
Chinese-Canadian, American, whatever. And when we sat down and asked for poutine, the waitress asked, do you want shredded cheese or Quebec style? So you can get either the crappy mozzarella or the really good cheese curd. So guess which one we chose. And it was really good.
Was there anything Chinese about it?
About the poutine. I mean, the rest of the menu is, you know, kind of classical Cantonese food.
Yeah, it's one of the weirder hyphenated cuisines, Canadian, Chinese.
Is anybody in this country doing one that you would consider?
Yes, yes, yes. In New Haven, Connecticut, Cassius, which is a cheese restaurant, has probably the greatest poutine outside of Canada that I have ever had. They make the French fries, you know, 2 minutes, you know, after you order them. The cheese is fabulous. The gravy is homemade. It's just a fabulous dish.
Mm. A whole new world has opened up. Thank you.
Bye.
Au revoir.
Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of the updated guidebook, Road Food. Check out their finds at splendidtable.org. Coming up, an ecological lesson in bone collecting and watch out microbrews. Apple cider is closing in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Rachel Maumaine made the now familiar tech to small batch food artisan leap a few years back. She went to work at the green markets, but it was not peaches, nor tomatoes, nor cheese she was inspired to work with. It was bones. She wanted to make high-quality bouillon, the kind we rarely see commercially. Well, she headed out in her Jetta with an empty trunk and began trawling upstate New York for bones. She made friends with sustainable farmers and began taking away trunkfuls of frozen bones, beef, chicken, fish. She then drove back to Brooklyn to turn them into the now-thriving Brooklyn Bouillon. Melissa Clark talked to Rachel about her start.
Hello, Rachel. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
So, Rachel, when did you first start collecting bones?
That's a great question. I moved to New York City from Seattle in 2010, and at that time, I didn't think I would go back into tech, had a little bit of money in the bank and could do what I wanted for the summer. And so I got a job at Green Markets with Hudson Valley Duck Farm, selling duck and meeting the farmers in New York State. I noticed that there was a gap between the farmer and the slaughterhouse and the butcher and all the way to the end consumer in transporting bones And at that point, as I started doing research, I realized the value of a good stock was lacking on the market for the home cook. So then I became a broker of bones.
So what was happening before you stepped in? What was happening to all those bones?
That is also a great question. I would say that it depends on the scale of the farm. Small farms really understand the value of the bones. They know all of their animals. And because of that, when they take their animals to harvest, they have the option to take the bones back. A lot of small farmers do, but it enters in challenges with transportation costs and the logistics associated with it. And sometimes storage is a challenge as well. However, on a larger scale, I see bones going to dog food. Some are going to hot composting. Neither are terrible routes. But bones to a chef are the gold of an animal, and it's what makes a beautiful foundation for our cooking. And so if we look at the supply chain of food, again, there's a place that I'm trying to establish where we can extract all of these beautiful nutrients and flavor from the bones and bring that back into the marketplace.
I've heard you talk about rescuing the bones. Is that what you mean?
Yes, that is what I mean.
So for the consumer, there's stocks that you can buy in cans, or you can buy a little frozen bouillon, but you can't really buy a good, flavorful stock.
Yes. I was doing research on the origins of bouillon, and in the 1800s, there was a gentleman who had a meat extract company, and he had a very high-quality meat extract that was then usurped by what we know as bouillon today, which is the tiny salty cubes. But the true etymology of bouillon means to brew. It's a liquid. It's a concentrated liquid. And so the effort of our companies to bring the true meaning of bouillon back to the home cook.
And when you collect these bones, how do you do it exactly? Do you drive to the farms and ask farmers for the bones? Do you go directly to the slaughterhouses? What's your process?
This is a matter of scale. We are a small company. I have relationships with all of the farms that we work with. And I'm very excited to say that each batch is entirely traceable back to the farm. So we might get grass-fed beef bones from one farm or pastured beef bones from another farm. And the label is always going to make that distinction. We're also building partnerships with butchers across the state who also have relationships with farms.
So when you make stock, you make these huge batches. But are there any techniques that you have that are transferable to people cooking stock at home? Any tips for us?
Absolutely. So the first tip is to start your water slow. And you want to start with cold water, and you want to bring the temperature up very gradually. At that point, you will have your washed, blanched, or roasted bones in the water, and proteins will rise to the surface and all of the impurities. And as you bring it up slowly, it allows those proteins to lift in an uncooked state such that you can capture them at the top and remove the impurities. If the water is boiling too rapidly, then it cooks those proteins, sucks them back into the water, and emulsifies into the stock, creating a cloudy and less pure and sometimes a distasteful stock. So that's number one. Then you add your vegetables, which will float to the top, continue to cook until the vegetables are done. And at that point, you've got a pretty stock.
Rachel, thank you so much. It's so great talking to you today.
Thank you for having me.
Rachel Mamane is the creator of Brooklyn Bouillon. Melissa Clark is a food columnist for the New York Times and author of Eat This Now. Now, you can find our recipe for those days when a regular old can of chicken stock is all you have on hand. It's a recipe to give it a little oomph. Take a look at Cheater's Homemade Broth. You can find it at splendidtable.org.
apple cider. Now that's what Johnny Appleseed was after when he planted his seeds all over the place. Hard cider, to be specific. The very drink turning up next to craft beers on restaurant wine lists. Well, Amy Traverso is a food writer with a love of all things cider. She wrote The Apple Lover's Cookbook. Rebecca Shear talked to her about that centuries-old quencher.
Amy, nice to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
So, Amy, I love what you write in your book. You refer to exploring cider as a worthy pursuit, and you write that the noble grape may sit at the top of the enological pyramid, but apples can produce wines and ciders with tremendous complexity, variability, and plain deliciousness. So how do you do that? How do you produce cider? And what is it exactly?
Cider is fermented apple juice. So in the U.S., we get a little confused because cider has come to be what we call fresh apple juice. But in the rest of the world, and historically, cider referred to apple juice that was fermented. And the reason apple juice was fermented is because before refrigeration, it was kind of hard to stop that from happening. So apples would just ferment naturally. So, you know, at some point in history, and it's hard to find exactly when, people started figuring out that apple juice could ferment and it could be alcohol and it could be tasty. Cider culture evolved. I think the first place we really see it taking root is in Spain, which I think a lot of people don't realize. There's a massive cider culture in Spain. But in any case, cider at one time in the U.S. was the most popular beverage for early Americans. It was safer than water. It was easy to make. It's a pretty simple process. It can go wrong. And I think people who have had funky cider know that. But it's actually a fairly simple process of, you know, you crush the apples, you extract the juice, and you let it ferment either with its own natural yeasts that exist on the skin or with, you know, special maybe champagne or wine yeast that you add to be a little more controlled about it. But say in John Adams' time, he drank a tankard of cider every day.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, it was children drank it because it was fairly low in alcohol and it was safer than water in a lot of places. So what happened was over time, cider kind of lost ground between the temperance movement and the arrival of Eastern European immigrants and the rise of beer culture. British people also brought beer, but cider was a little bit easier to make, so that's why it was more popular in the early era.
And it seems like it's had a resurgence.
It is having a huge resurgence. It's really exciting. It's gotten to the point where it's really all I drink. I love it, and I love seeing people rediscovering because it was part of our culture that we lost and really forgot about. So since about the 1980s in this country, when some makers, in particular West County Cider in Western Massachusetts, Terry and Judith Mahoney were some early cider reintroduction pioneers. In Europe, in England, cider's having huge revival over the past 10 years, and you're seeing growth about 100% every year in terms of cider consumption. So it's growing quickly. It's still a relatively small corner, pocket of domestic wine and beer and spirits consumption, but it's really growing quickly. It's the fastest growing drinks category in the country.
Now, what regions produce cider?
In our country, it's really concentrated in the Northeast, the upper Midwest, sort of Great Lakes area, the Pacific Northwest, and some in the Virginia area. There's also a lot happening in British Columbia, Ontario, and Quebec. So there's a lot in Canada as well. And if you think about, you know, how hard it can be, there are certainly grapes that do grow well in northern climates, and winemakers are getting better and better at it. I mean, here in New England where I live, there's actually really good wine being made. But apples thrive in cold climates, and it is a truly local beverage. So, you know, if you want to eat and drink locally, apple cider is a great option. And as more and more cider makers are coming online, you know, you're more and more likely to find apple cider being made nearby.
Well, if we want to go out and buy a bottle of cider, what should we look for?
You may want to start with what's local to you because it's always fun to go to the cidery. It's always fun to see it made. It's great to support your local people. But, you know, cider is international. It's made all over the world. The tricky thing is finding it. Because cider is still in a resurgence, it can be hard to get. For me, it can be hard to find West Coast cider, for example. You know, France, England, Spain, they don't always export their best stuff, so it can be hard to even find that. So France is a little bit better. For example, there's a French maker called Etienne Dupont from Normandy who tends to export some pretty great stuff. I've seen it in many stores around the country. Another French brand that exports is Eric Bordelais. You can often find that. But the nice thing about cider is it's a really low investment. You can get a great bottle for $8. $12 is sort of at the upper end. You know, in general, I think France is a good place to start because the French are really good at making just delicious ciders with enough kind of residual sweetness in them that they're super friendly to the new drinker. Spanish cider is really great, but it tends to be a little more acidic, which if you're new to it, you might not like as much. Where I live, there's so many great ciders coming online. There's Bantam Cider here in Cambridge that everybody's crazy about, and suddenly it's on tap in so many restaurants. It's really fun. So, you know, it's always good to sort of look around and see what's coming online where you live.
Nice. So once we get our hands on a bottle or we get it on tap somewhere, what would you recommend pairing with cider?
I think cider is one of the most food-friendly beverages in the world. It does have that fruitiness and can have sweetness. Some of them are very dry, but some of them have sweetness, which make them pair with so many foods. And also it has the fizz. So when you're eating food and then you drink your cider, the little bubbles are like cleaning off your tongue. They're balancing any richness or fattiness in your food. So it can go with foods anywhere from curries to barbecue to creamy sauces. But if you want sort of rules, you can say, okay, well, cider from Normandy is going to go really well with foods from there. So your creamy cheeses like Camembert or, you know, mussels cooked in a cider cream sauce is going to be amazing. If you're in Spain, you're going to really enjoy that with tapas, with, you know, pork dishes that have some fat or with grilled steaks, things that are hearty because of that extra acidity. In England, it's actually ciders. Some of the commercial ciders that tend to be sweeter are really good with fish and chips and fried food because they have that sweetness and that fizz, but also great with cheddar. You know, in general, cheeses pair incredibly well with cider. Oh, and blue cheeses for sweeter ciders, like in particular ice ciders, which are kind of very concentrated, sweet, nectary dessert ciders, are incredible with blue cheese and with nuts. So you can really do a nice cheese platter and have a cider tasting and even include some dried sausages, and you'd have a really great feast.
Well, Amy Traverso, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Amy Traverso is author of the Apple Lovers Cookbook. Rebecca Shear is the host of Metro Connection on WAMU in Washington, D.C. Now, Amy left us with her recipe for apple chestnut stuffed pork loin with cider sauce. It's at splendidtable.org. We are talking to you this hour. All right, let's get to your questions. Connect with us at 800-537-5252. And remember, you can always get in touch with us on Facebook and Twitter. We have Kate calling from Bellingham, Washington. Kate, what's on your mind?
Hi, Lynn. My husband and child and I have been crabbing, and we have found the sweet spot. We're getting about 15 crabs every time we go out, and they're the big, old, mean Dungeness crabs, out of inspiration.
Oh, boy. All right. Well, what have you done so far?
I'm originally from Ohio, so my crab experience is limited. So I've just steamed them with garlic and lemon butter, and I've made some crab cakes, and that's about it.
That's about it. Okay, how about some crab salad?
Ooh,
so now, if you steam them... But steam them with a little olive oil and garlic, okay?
Uh-huh.
And then, you know, clean them completely so you don't get any bits of shell and cartilage.
I'm getting pretty good at that.
This is good. This is good. And now I'm going to take you down a Scandinavian route with this.
Mm-hmm.
Something a little different because everybody does the, you know, the mayo and the whatever. But how about instead? There is a mustard sauce that's used with gravlax, you know, which is the cured salmon.
Uh-huh.
But doing a variation of it would be fabulous, just a little bit of it tossed with the cold crab. It's a dark, grainy mustard, okay?
Okay.
And you want probably a half a cup of it. You want about
3 tablespoons of sugar. And then you want a little bit of minced onion, like 2 tablespoons, 3 tablespoons. And about 3 tablespoons of vinegar. And a little bit of canola oil. 2 tablespoons, let's say. And you're going to whip that together. And what you want to taste for is a sweet tart balance. But the mustard is the main event. You don't want to overwhelm the flavor of the mustard. So you play with that. And then you throw in about 1/2 cup or more of chopped dill. You want this thing to be loaded with dill. Now, however much amount of crab meat you have, and keep it in fairly sizable pieces if you can, you know, big shreds. Mm-hmm. Toss a tablespoon or two into the crab meat. You don't want to overwhelm the crab meat.
Okay.
And then what I do is I use shredded hearts of romaine, or if you can get something like frisée, you know, that really tart, prickly salad. It's very tart.
Yeah.
It's delicious with this. And you make a little bed of that, and then you pile this on top of it. And you can top it with, you know, more shreds of the dill or a little bit of minced red onion. But that's it. And it's
good. Ooh, that sounds so
good.
Elegant.
Well, it is, and it also can be a main dish. You know, you put out a big platter of that with the salad, and if you want to put a little oil and vinegar dressing on the greens, that's sort of a nice, fresh contrast. But that's it. And it's really simple. You know, and then you can put any dressing on the crab you want. There's, from New Orleans, you can look up remoulade dressings. You could do a straight oil and vinegar. And you can do an Asian dressing. If you look up Vietnamese recipes for spring rolls, there's a dipping sauce that you make with fish sauce and sugar and lime or lemon or rice vinegar. Fabulous to marinate the crab in.
Ooh, that sounds really good.
Just,
I could probably stick some crab in the spring rolls, too.
They would be wonderful in spring rolls. They will make you crazy. You will all fall on the floor with delight. So go forth. How lucky you are. Hey, crab, you're going to have a blast.
Thank you. Yes, it feels like a champagne problem for sure.
Yeah, I know. What do you do when you have too much? Take care, Kate.
Oh, thank you so much for your help, Lynn.
You're welcome. We're going to be back in a minute with the latest in the fermentation craze, the ginger bug. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Well, we're talking to you this hour. Connect with us at 800-537-5252. Shoot us an email. Go to splendidtable.org and get in touch with us on Facebook and Twitter. Okay, back to your questions. We've got Chase calling from Los Angeles. Chase, what's on your mind?
Hey, Lynn. Well, I live in Los Angeles now, but I'm originally from Utah. And back home in Utah, we have a gorgeous apple tree in our backyard. We aren't exactly sure what type of apples they are, but they're essentially, when you think of the perfect pie apple, it's this one, very tart, very crisp. But, of course, we get buckets and buckets and buckets,
buckets
of apples.
Buckets and buckets, yes.
Yep. And so, I mean, we've done everything. We've made apple sauce. We've made apple jams. We've made we made bottles and bottles of apple pie filling that we ended up giving away. We literally could not give away enough of them. So I just wanted to ask if you had any cool suggestions.
You know, when it comes to that kind of thing, especially when you've got an apple that's really distinctive, do you know how rare it is these days to get that kind of apple? Most of them are far too sweet for pie. You're really lucky. Anyway, what about chutney? What about relishes? You know, there's so many recipes for green apple or apple chutney, and the marriage is usually onion, the apple, some kind of sweetener. It may be usually brown sugar, but if you want to, you know, you could use white sugar and keep some of that color quality going. And then spices, and they're kind of up to you. But if you look in you know, some preserving sites, and I would check our site, splendidtable.org, because I have lost track. We've got thousands of recipes at this point.
Yeah.
But the point is, You can make the basic recipe and change the flavorings. And you can make it very savory with a lot less sugar. And you can add things like corn to it and onion and shallots and, you know, that sort of thing. Or, and by the way, butternut squash is really fabulous with tart green apples.
Oh, it sounds wonderful.
Yeah, FYI. So that's one way to go. And then another way to go is doing rum apples for Christmas. Now, I realize people are probably getting a lot of apple gifts from you, but you do take a good rum, you know, something that's really rich tasting, and take a couple of vanilla beans, split them, and sugar to taste. Put that in a saucepan, bring it to a boil. Take your apples, drop them in, chunks of the apples. Just let them cook for just a couple of moments. Pack them into jars so they're completely covered. And then let them stand. And now when you're done with that, those apples can go into pies. They can just on their own go over pancakes. Any way you want to use them, they're fabulous roasted with pork.
Oh, that sounds great.
Yeah. And that's another thing to do. Think about cutting them in quarters and slow roasting them with greens and peppers and all kinds of other, the butternut squash is one thing. So you
Absolutely.
Do them as a side dish. Now that means, of course, that's for your, you know, your friends and your family, but they're really wonderful as a savory.
That sounds great.
I hope it's helped. It sounds like you have more apples than you're ever going to be able to use.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, they only come in once every other year. So it
oh,
is
really?
A treat, but yeah, it's one of the trees that only comes in every other year. So this is a year that we're going to have to make use of them.
Are your folks going to be shipping some to you in L.A.?
Well, I go home for part of the time, and then I live out here for music and stuff, and you should check it out. It's chasetheband.com.
Okay, Chase, we will.
Yeah, but no, I'm going to be going home, and so I'm just trying to help out the family with all the apples because I know my family's going to be hard at work peeling them and canning them and doing whatever, and then, of course, when I get home, I'll be doing the same.
I hope it's a big family.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, Chase, enjoy them, and thanks for the tip about the band.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
Bye.
I have to say, you know, this is an issue of mine. Tart apples for pie, okay? You know, when you make pie, you really want an apple with snap and acidity. You can always sweeten it, but the whole idea is to have that contrast. And there's just a handful. There's the Granny Smith, but that borders on being almost too sweet. I just came across Northern Greenings, and that's an old apple. Anything with the word greening in it is going to be a pie apple. And by the way, if you want to figure out what kind of apple to buy, for what purpose, we have got a guide on the website, splendidtable.org. 7,000 apples and how to choose the ones you need for the job you want to do. It's a really simple chart and it's really nifty. And by the way, there's a ton of apple recipes on the site. You can reach us on Facebook and Twitter, and you can send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. Denise is on the line from Tower, Minnesota. Hey, Denise, welcome.
Thank you. I'm calling because I'd like to have more recipes for wild rice. I harvest wild rice, and I'm tired of the variations of the hot dish we have up here.
Oh, you're up in wild rice country, and you actually harvest your own?
Yes, I'm Chippewa Indian. I've been harvesting wild rice since I was about 11. I'm in my 50s now.
Oh, Denise, what a heritage.
Yeah, we have great wild rice that's hand-parched. And if you harvest it the same day that you pick it, you get this green rice. We don't even sell it because you lose 50%, and it's this wonderful flavor. And it's too exhausting to sell and is too flavorful to want to sell.
Why do you lose half of it? Is it the chaff?
If you let the rice sit a couple days before you parch it, it hardens. And if you do it the same day you harvest it, it's still kind of green in some places. And so it's not the chaff, it's the rice itself.
Ah, and when you parch, is that where you actually are roasting the rice?
You're roasting the rice over an open fire, and you're pushing it back and forth with wooden cedar paddles. And they try to duplicate it with machines, but for some reason, the unevenness of the fire makes the rice have qualities it doesn't have when you machine finish it. For example, you can take the rice and deep fry it, and it'll come out like puffed rice. Oh. And machine-finished rice won't do that.
Really? Interesting. You have my mouth watering. I feel like I should be asking you exactly what you do with the rice. But, you know, if this green rice is so glorious on its own, I mean, do you just eat it plain? Because I would imagine it would be so delicious.
Oh, it is. In fact, we eat it with butter, and just by itself it's so glorious. But then one of my favorite dishes of all time is we have ducks that eat on the wild rice beds. And so when my dad or my nephew now will go hunting, they'll give us the ducks that have the flavor of the rice built into their meat. And so you get these ducks that don't taste like any other in the world. And then you have them roast on a bed of wild rice, and the flavor of the duck goes into the rice.
This is amazing. You know, I don't know if I can offer anything that's going to be better than that.
We have a lot of cookbooks up on the Iron Range in Minnesota, and they all have variations of the wild rice hot dish with the cream of chicken and cream of mushrooms. And
yeah, but that kills the wild rice.
It does. It's not the same. I mean, it's a favorite up here, but I just would like to do something different with it.
The wild rice you have, I mean, it's spectacular in flavor, and I wouldn't want to, you know, mess around with it. Mm-hmm. And if you've got something like wild onions or just regular onion, it would be lovely to take the onion and take almonds, just cracked whole almonds.
Oh, that sounds great.
You know, that could really work. And I'm just thinking any other nut, you know, walnut, something that is fresh and delicious. It doesn't have to be local, obviously, because almonds aren't local. But slowly, slowly in butter, saute that in a skillet. And then turn the wild rice into that. And let it just very slowly work in that skillet. And then add either broth from the duck or even water and salt and pepper. And if you want to add some herbs, I think the herb that might work best in this case might be something like rosemary or basil. But even just letting those flavors kind of sit up and take notice, because toasting the almonds in butter with the onion, which will just pick up a bit of color. The heat is really gentle. I think you'll end up with something that'll show off the rice rather in a way like you do the green rice. And it'd just be such a celebration on its own.
That sounds wonderful, actually. It's making my mouth water.
If you wanted to add small bits of, you know, delicious pork or cured pork of some kind, but I mean small bits. It's a seasoning. It's not the main event. That might be the spark. You know, that just might be the contrast. But I just think it would be delicious.
I think so, too.
I would try that. And some salad. As far as I'm concerned, that could be dinner. Denise, thank you.
Oh, yes.
Enjoy that rice. Take care.
Yes. Okay.
Bye. 800-537-5252. Facebook, Twitter, email, go to splendidtable.org. In this golden age of home brews and cultures with sauerkraut, beer, kombucha, kimchi, and yogurt all bubbling on countertops, we have something new for you to ferment. A ginger bug. A mix of ginger and sugar that serves as the base for homemade sodas. Sally Swift went to the mind behind NourishKitchen.com, Jennifer McGruther, for some details on this mysterious brew.
Hey, Jennifer, thanks for joining us. Thank you so much for having me.
So tell me about this ginger bug that we found on your website.
Well, ginger bug is a traditional way for fermenting sodas. And it is a wild ferment. That means that it takes advantage of all the wild yeasts and bacteria that exist naturally in your home. It's essentially a slurry of sugar and ginger and water. And that combination helps to promote the proliferation of beneficial bacteria and wild yeast. So it functions a lot like a sourdough starter.
Mm-hmm.
The way a sourdough starter might leaven bread, a ginger bug can give homemade sodas their fizz and their bubbles. So it's a really remarkable way to make homemade sodas.
So it's almost like kombucha in a way, the sweetened tea that you ferment. But you usually add a mother or something to a kombucha, right? With the ginger bug, it becomes its own bacteria, correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
Kombucha is a fermented tonic, very similar to homemade soda, except that a kombucha relies on a SCOBY, or mm-hmm. that is a symbiotic colony of bacteria and yeast, to give it its bacteria. Whereas a ginger bug relies, it's a wild ferment, so it relies on the bacteria and yeast that exist naturally in your environment, on your hands, on your cooking utensils, to inoculate this slurry of, you know, ginger and sugar with the bacteria that will eventually make your homemade sodas fizzy and fermented.
So how do you go about making your own ginger bug?
Well, the great way, it's very, very easy to start. And fortunately, you only need two ingredients, essentially, and that's fresh ginger and whole unrefined cane sugar, although white sugar will work as well. And essentially, you take a knob of ginger and you grate it until you have about 2 heaping tablespoons, and then you combine that with 2 tablespoons sugar and 2 tablespoons filtered water. So it's a really easy recipe to remember.
Mm-hmm.
And you let that sit on your countertop, and every day for about 5 days, and again, because it's wild ferment, it may take more or less time depending on your kitchen and your environment. But every day for 5 days, mix an additional 2 tablespoons ginger, 2 tablespoons sugar, and 2 tablespoons water into your jar. And eventually, this will create an environment that allows beneficial bacteria to proliferate, and that will be your ginger bug.
And I'm assuming you're uncovered, because if you cover it, the bacteria is not getting in. Is that correct?
Well, the bacteria will get into a covered environment. However, you want to make sure that it's not an airtight environment in this case. One of the best ways to cover it is actually using cheesecloth, and that will allow the ferment to breathe, essentially, which attracts wild yeast.
Mm-hmm. And so how do you use it?
So once you have it nice and bubbly, so again, this takes about 5 days, you'll notice that it takes on a yeasty smell similar to beer brewing, and that's the bacteria and yeast doing their work. And at that point, you strain off about 1/4 cup of the liquid, mix that into sweetened tea, fruit juice, or a combination, and then you pour it into a flip-top bottle or mason jar and secure that tightly. So at this point, you want it to be airtight, because that is what's going to set the bubbles. And let it ferment for about 3 to 5 days after that. If you're using a mason jar, make sure to burp it from time to time to prevent over-accumulation of carbon dioxide and other
gases.
Or
it's going to blow?
That's something you should be careful of. It's unusual to have homemade ferments like kombuchas or, you know, ginger ales and the like explode. But it does happen depending on how hot your kitchen is. And again, it's a very, very rare event. But that's why you want to burp the jar if you're using a mason jar. Flip-top bottles, by contrast, they have a safety mechanism in that if it becomes too overrun with gas as it ferments, it'll simply open up the top on its own.
Okay. All right. That seems like the safe route to me. Jennifer, it's such an interesting topic. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Jennifer Magruder is the author of The Nourished Kitchen. Get your own ginger bug. You can find her recipe at thesplendidtable.org. Well, that's it for today. Be sure to join us next week. And in the meantime, let me leave you with this thought from Anne of Green Gables by L.M. Montgomery. I'm so glad I live in a world where there are Octobers. The The Splendid Table is produced by APM American Public Media. Visit splendidtable.org to get information on everything you heard here today and so much more. Recipes, get registered for our weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. Take a look at our e-books and be sure to visit our podcast network, Infinite Guest. You'll find The Splendid Table there, as well as a collection of other shows like A Tiny Sense of Accomplishment from best-selling authors and best pals, Sherman Alexie and Jess Walter. It's all about works in progress and occasionally basketball. That's infiniteguest.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Laura Kalibi. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz. Our theme music is composed by Sam Keenan. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We're going to be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.